Hello, everyone out there in Cooperative Radio Land. It is 8 o'clock in Vancouver, and of course, that means it's time for Each for All, the Cooperative Connection here on Vancouver Co-op Radio. We're very happy to have with us in the studio Camilo Cortez, who is going to be sharing with us the story of Umbrella Multicultural Health Cooperative. It's a pretty exciting organization, and it's a member-driven, not-for-profit health services organization, helping members who face barriers in accessing health care due to their language and culture. And we have in the studio with us Camilo Cortez. He's a founding member of the Umbrella Multicultural Health Co-op, and until recently he served as the Umbrella Mobile Clinic Coordinator and is now a volunteer on that project. He is passionate about equal access to medical services for all. And we'll check in with him later about some of the next projects that he's going to be working on. But he's a passionate member of the Umbrella Multicultural Health Co-op. Thanks so much for joining us in the studio tonight, Camilo.
Yes, thank you for having me, guys. It's great to be here.
So this is a really interesting co-op. It's a health cooperative, but you're looking at serving communities that need additional service to the standard health services offered by the province.
Yeah, definitely. We operate based on need, and what we want to do is engage everybody in the cooperative. So every member ideally would be engaged in the cooperative, asking us for specific projects or deciding how to create something that we don't have currently. Even if the health authority cannot provide it, maybe we can still figure out a way to do it. So that's how we like to think about things.
And who are your members? What communities are being served here?
Our mission is to provide services to people who have had difficulty accessing services based on culture, on language, on a number of other things that prevent regular medical service from happening. So really, it's very broad. At this time, we're working with a lot of different cultural communities. I believe maybe as many as 11. And it depends on the project, but every cultural community is different.
And so you mentioned some of these barriers, language and culture. Can you give us like an example of what a cultural barrier might be?
Sure. This might not be very obvious to everybody, but medical services are a cultural thing. So, for example, some cultures will really appreciate it when you receive them in the medical office by touching hands, you know, just like a regular handshake would be. And here, maybe that's not always the practice. So that's just an example. And so as soon as that's established, and maybe you miss that, and in that culture, that's a sign of trust, immediately, like, you just start shifting the relationship towards something that is not as positive. And so that's just a small example of things, but you could have anything. You could have simply doctors that know some Spanish, for example, and they say a particular word, which actually means the opposite, just because their Spanish is not as fluent. That's just another example. We use most of our services use health brokers, which are culturally competent and medically trained professionals that usually in their home country have been doctors, nurses, or medical professionals of some kind. And here they can come and help us out because they understand the culture, understand both ways of doing things, and can navigate the system quite well.
That's really interesting. So I noticed on your website, you mentioned this cross-cultural health broker model. Yeah. Is this something used around the world, or is this something that you guys developed?
In a way, it's used in various parts of the world. I know in the States they use it quite a bit. We began by looking at a model of a health co-op from Edmonton. So there in Edmonton, there's quite a strong health co-op there, and they use health brokers. And so we've learned from those experiences, and so we've sort of devised our own way of training our health brokers and began working in different projects towards the communities that we serve.
That's really neat. And I mentioned in the intro there that you were the coordinator of this Umbrella Mobile Clinic. Can you tell us what that's all about?
Sure. Well, the mobile clinic in particular serves agricultural workers that come and work at fields, and they usually come for on a temporary basis. And so they really face a lot of issues because their English is definitely not there. They come to work. So it's a very, it's like a boot camp, but just for work. So they're working full on all the time. And so for them to always have a lot of time off, it's a difficult thing. So one of the issues that they have is they live in rural areas and accessing medical services because it's too far, because it's close, is one of the issues they have. And then when they get there, they can't speak the language. So there are some difficulties that way. So we've developed a system that works quite well. We've seen probably about 200 people or 200 patient visits so far this year. And we develop a system along with other partners and organizations that also work in that area. And we're able to see patients quite a bit, pretty often.
And so who is personing the mobile health units? Are they nurse practitioners? Are they physicians?
Well, we work mainly, everybody that works, except for a few, very few staff that we have, are volunteers. And so we are accepting volunteers for those out there who want to help us out. We usually accept doctors, nurse practitioners, and we go through some training for them to understand the way we work. And at the same time, if you don't have medical knowledge, you can still help us in the other part of the medical practice, which is, for example, when you go to a doctor, you have to fill out a form. There's a lot of things going on for the patient that we see to be able to fill out that form. So we have an intake volunteer, we have volunteers that manage our medical records. So there's lots of different types of people that can come and help us out.
So these aren't services covered by BC Medical?
For the mobile clinic in particular, we can get some services covered, but our role, as we see it, is to provide the service regardless of whether it's covered or not. So we do provide primary care. That's all we can provide with a trailer. But we try our best to go as far as we can with the limited resources we have. We are fundraising actively towards this, and we have a fundraiser that I can tell you about. It's a Noche de Salsa. It's pretty fun. We've done it 3 times already. This is the 3rd time, actually. And it's fun. We have a salsa teacher. We have a DJ. It's usually a really, really fun night. So
I did want to get a sense of the community. Now, you're mentioning a lot of the temporary foreign workers you're seeing are Spanish-speaking. How does this typically look when you arrive in a community and or at a farm or at a location and you're with the umbrella mobile clinic? Do you advertise beforehand that you're going to come that day, or are you asked to come by people?
We've been very lucky. We've worked with many people that are knowledgeable of the type of people that we try to serve in the mobile clinic. So we've always worked with partners since the beginning. The mobile clinic was our first project, and it was created because we had those connections. And I really want to say thank you to all of them. All our partners have been amazing. And so it depends. We try to get them to go when they have free time. So we figure out what the free time is, and it more or less stays the same. It can change. But when their free time happens, we make it happen that we're there.
Yeah. And what type of illnesses or preventative measures are you treating? Or
it's very diverse, I would say. Yeah. I know a lot about the mobile clinic because I was the recent coordinator. I can tell you about the other projects as well. But I know that every so often we get serious cases, and we also like to treat in a preventative manner many, many sorts of things. So we have worked with sexual health. We have also worked working with musculoskeletal injuries, and really anything that they want to come and ask us about medically related, we're here to help.
And are people, are people pretty open to this, or is this kind of a foreign concept to have people show up and want to address health issues?
You mean the patients?
Mm-hmm.
I think over time they're learning about us. The system, how it works here, for example, is very different than how it works in Ontario, where they also have many temporary workers that work in the fields. So I would say they learn through time what the service does and what it can do for them. And then they decide to go or not go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I want to come back to some of your other programs in a minute, but I wanted to get a sense of how this all started. So like, you were one of the founding members.
Yeah.
What was the process in deciding that there was this need and it could be filled by a co-op?
Well, for a while now, a few people that were working in the community in different projects or just as volunteers had been talking about making something happen that was more responsive. And so just among those conversations we came up with the idea of beginning to do projects. And at the same time, we were looking at models of how this could work. And the co-op project just fit right in. The co-op model just seemed to work really well because what we wanted was responsiveness for the people we were trying to approach, and that they themselves would then come back, become more knowledgeable about their co-op and more empowered, and then do the same to other people.
And how did you identify this need in the community?
A lot of us have been working in the community at that time. For example, I used to work with immigrant services, so I knew a lot of my clients were going through a lot of situations. And currently, most of the immigrant services happen for refugees, and there's a time limit for that. So even if you, for example, if you are a 60-year-old grandma that came not as a refugee, you'll still have a ton of trouble just trying to find the adequate services for yourself. So yeah, there's no gap. There's a big gap there for service.
Mm-hmm. And you've on your website, you point out that there's a big list of languages that you cater to: Arabic, Dari, Farsi, Hindi, Pashto, Punjabi, Spanish, Tigra, and a couple other ones that I'm not going to try and pronounce right now. How did you gather this many resources to be able to help in all of these languages?
I would say we work with our nails. It's very, very on a project-by-project basis. So currently we have our offices in New Westminster. If people are interested, they can come to our website or give us a call, check out the projects we have. Not every project is for every language. So the mobile clinic is mainly Spanish. And we have other projects that also involve health brokers, and our health brokers speak all those languages and come with all those cultural competencies.
And so how many people are members today?
Oh, today. I'm going to have to guess because I did the count last year. So today, I don't know. I'm going to say about 80.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Awesome. And then, so you mentioned earlier wanting to have an engaged membership.
Yes.
Wanting to have members who are part of the decision-making process. What does that look like for the co-op? What does that governance structure look like?
It's always changing. What we're trying to do is we're trying to keep everybody as informed as possible. It's really complicated when everybody speaks different languages. Some people don't read. Some people do read. And it's also complicated when we ask them for feedback, because culturally feedback it's given it in so many different ways. So we're trying all the time to figure out ways to do this. A lot of our members could actually work for us, because that's the point. Our health brokers have also faced these barriers and stuff like that. So some of the people that have worked with us have been our members or patients. Can then eventually come and work for us, stuff like that. The AGM is a big thing for us. We try to make it as responsive as possible, as diverse as possible. It's a work in progress. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always hard.
Yeah. And I guess I forgot to ask, when did you incorporate?
Oh, 2011.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've been around for a few years now.
Yeah, we've been around for a few years. We've started a number of projects, and they've always been small by scale because we really enjoy working with people in a very direct way. And I just wanted to say, we also serve non-members. You don't have to become a member. You can just come and check us out. But we want members to be the ones that decide how our co-op directs their resources.
Yeah, neat. Yeah. And now I am curious how you sort of came to incorporate. And also, I know that you have a relationship with the British Columbia Multicultural Health Services Society.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, what is that relationship? How does that work?
Well, as I told you at the beginning, there were a few of us that kept meeting and kept trying to figure what's the next step that needed for immigrant medical services. And VCMHSS has a long history of providing medical services for immigrants. So they were instrumental in helping us figure out and providing actual physical space for meetings and things like that, so that we could actually meet and figure out what we wanted to do. We've had some great people to talk to about co-ops and co-op development, and that was really useful. So I don't know if can I say their name?
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Well, Van City was really useful. Yeah. And also Melanie Kahn, yeah, who is a very well-known co-op developer everywhere. And yeah, their knowledge is amazing.
Awesome. So. Yeah. We love Melanie Kahn here, yeah, and Van City.
Yeah.
You did mention the other organization out of Edmonton. And are they a co-op as well?
I believe they are.
Okay.
Yes.
And they work with the broker model. Did you... to have a lot of back and forth with them when you were getting set up?
We did, not me directly. I believe it was our director who was in touch with them at all times to figure out the health broker model. Yes.
That's pretty neat. Okay, so I did want to touch on some of the other programs that you have.
Yes.
You have a pediatric health outreach program. Maybe you could explain what that's about.
Sure. The name is PetHub. And what we're trying to do is to facilitate pediatric services for people who have a really hard time getting the service. So we do have a pediatrician on site, not at all times. In our office in New West, we're able to provide services. We have a family physician, a family doctor, and we have a pediatrician. And so with the pediatrician in particular, the Pet Hub program, we work with the health brokers. When somebody needs to refer a patient to a pediatrician, they can do it to us because we have so many different languages that we can work with. And the cultural aspects of working with kids, it's a big deal.
So, I mean, I guess I feel a bit ignorant because I don't really know what a lot of the cultural challenges might be. What are some of the major challenges culturally that people have around pediatricians and dealing with different cultures?
Not in particular with pediatricians. With every medical service, we try to facilitate the service. So when there are situations, for example, there could be a disagreement between a doctor and a patient where the patient does not know how to... negotiate some kind of service that they think is necessary. So there's usually the medical system, how it works is the doctor is the decision maker, whereas the patient is the person that just receives the direction as to what they have to do. What we're trying to do is actually change that. So we have the health broker to negotiate between both parties. And so the reason we create that system is for a more back and forth communication process between the doctor or the pediatrician and the patient.
And this all happens in one room at one time. You have the patient, the doctor, and the broker in the middle.
Yes, correct.
Interesting. Yeah.
And it's even if you just do a family doctor, the system works in the similar way. So a lot of the time, my experience is I'm an immigrant as well, and my family, when they go to a doctor, they'll be very happy that the doctor has seen them, even though they had to wait for hours, and even though the doctor sees them for 5 minutes, and they gave them a pill. And when they come out, I'm like, "What? How can this be? There needs to be more accountability. I need to ask you more questions. I need to know better what's going on in my parents' life or my life medically speaking, so that we can move forward. And so the health broker role is kind of trying to achieve more knowledge that way.
Well, and it seems like a very important role. This is someone who needs to be culturally sensitive.
Yes.
And it also is someone who needs to have at least some pretty good knowledge about the way that the health sector works.
Yeah.
So who are the people that you have found that are best suited for this broker? And like, what is their training?
Our health brokers, I think they're wonderful. It depends on the community. We've worked for the mobile clinic. We've worked since 2011 with a number of brokers, and they're amazing, and we know them really well. For the other cultures, you have to go slow and just develop the person as a health broker as you're working with them. Partly because, for example, for me, I only speak Spanish with regards to the other projects, so I couldn't really guide somebody else in a different language. But what we can do is keep training them. So we try to give continuous training to our health brokers to make it work. And how we find them is actually, there's so many people here that are very qualified from their countries, and so they come, and it's just a matter of figuring out how to use those skills positively. So we have a lot of doctors and pharmacists and nurses as well in the past. Yeah.
Yeah. And how are they finding you? How do you reach out to them, and how do you connect with these people?
I think it's probably been word of mouth mostly. Yeah. Yeah, with the communities that we work in. Yeah, and it works well.
And I noticed you have a Facebook page. Is that another one of your outreach tools for finding brokers?
Yeah, we don't use it as much. I think it's more, it depends. For the projects, for the maternal projects that we have, where we have similar projects where to other baby programs, where we'll teach moms about what to expect when you're pregnant and afterwards how to take care of your child and things like that. Obviously, I don't run that program, but yeah. Then Facebook is a great tool for communication with them, because they're always busy. So when they have a chance, they go there.
Well, and everybody knows that Facebook is where you go and post pictures of your children.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Totally.
So I did want to talk a bit more about some of the other programs you guys offer there. We talked about the mobile clinic, which is super interesting. It seems like a pretty unique model, but you also offer pediatric services. And I noticed on your website you have some resources about diabetes, and I'm wondering if this is something that is specific to the members of your group. Is this something that touches them quite a bit?
I know that for immigrants, when they arrive here, their health decreases over time.
Yeah.
And in particular, because they cannot access appropriate food, the food that they're usually, what they're used to seeing or buying or getting a hold of in their home countries, it's quite hard to get here. So a normal thing that happens is because you're on a budget, you get the same types of food all the time and not as good quality. So that eventually develops into health issues, and diabetes is one of them. That's correct. And so we have a diabetes project right now. It's mostly with the goal of educating the public. It's not just for our members, it's for everybody, in a bunch of different languages. And with volunteers, we're also we have events, and we assess people's diabetes status.
So I
without diagnosing.
So how would you go about assessing somebody's diabetes status?
So there is a test, and it's run by one of our health brokers, who is a physician in her home country. And this test simply tells you whether you're at risk or not. And if your levels end up being somewhat higher than what we expect, we recommend that then they go get themselves checked by a medical professional that can diagnose them.
So is this something that we could like do right now, or is this something that you require as a blood test or
you
something?
You do require about 5 hours.
Okay.
You do need to get up really early in the morning. It's a baseline measurement, and then they give you, I believe they give you juice or something that will change your sugars. And
oh, okay.
Then they can measure you again.
All right, that's interesting. I had no idea. I thought maybe we could do the test on Dale right now.
Yeah, but, for sure.
So you mentioned that this is really an issue with people's with their food, and that can't find food that they're used to cooking. It sounds obviously like one of those cultural barriers that you're talking about. Do you help with people in these preventative measures as well?
We've done that in the past. We've done cooking classes and cooking circles for people, and we've also had partners that have provided us with food for that. That was quite a while ago. We haven't done any of those projects recently, mostly just because of time limitations, I would say. We don't have enough time. But yeah, we've done it. Yeah, it's in the past, that, and we probably could do it again pretty soon, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of some of the conversations we've been having with Vanessa Hammond. She is out of Victoria and works with the Healthcare Cooperative Federation of Canada.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming
you've
heard of her.
Yeah.
And they do a lot of work with Hans Kai circles. And this seems to be one of the things that they're really looking to as a way of galvanizing communities to really address health issues and deal with preventative measures. Did you guys evaluate that model as well?
Not like that, actually. No, that sounds really interesting. I think we would be interested in looking at that model.
Okay. Yeah, we've talked with her quite a bit. There's a group, Norwest Co-op, they're out of Winnipeg, that brought over the model started in Japan, but they translated it from Japanese into English and have been using this model in Winnipeg and also looking to get the word out across Canada. So it's a pretty neat model, but it's around finding community groups that exist and seeing how they can integrate sort of preventative health measures and communication around health topics and issues with existing community groups. And,
sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the other things I saw on your site, you have a program about empowering Latin American women in the childbirthing year. This is postnatal, so this is our pre and postnatal support. Is this something that is another challenge of the community that arrives here?
Yes, a little bit. So there are a lot of moms, I would say, that because maybe lack of some of resources or lack of Spanish English, they'll have a bit of a harder time accessing services. So maybe they won't find out that you can get a midwife as part of the medical service system. And so our role would be just to start letting them know as soon as we know that they're pregnant and that they're here with us, that those things are out there for them to get. At the same time, there are a lot of very positive things that happen as soon as they get all together and they start supporting each other. So we kind of take a little bit of a back roll, more like just creating the space and creating the things that they need, and they will just start figuring out what they need and asking for those things. And I'm, of course, not talking about me because this is not my program, but we have a very lovely person behind this. Her name is Raquel, and she lives for this type of programming. And she really loves doulas and midwives and the whole process before and after. And so she's really involved with everything that has to do with babies.
Well, it seems like a really powerful program. And it kind of makes me think you guys, it sounds like you do some advocacy work as well. You're connecting people with information about the resources that they might just not have a clue are even out there for them.
Yeah, completely. And we do advocacy work, trying to ensure that people are safe and get the proper services that they need. That's the base of our services, yeah.
And so how does it work for a handoff for somebody who comes into your clinic and is looking for health services, and then you hand them off to other services like run by the province or other organizations? What does that look like?
Well, I guess it depends on the project, but we can also work with them as they're working with somebody else. Because we are more independent than other organizations. For most projects, we are not funded by any particular branch of the government, or we're not funded by things that limit our services, then we are very free to continue services. We're not in competition with anybody. We would just want to complement whatever is needed for our members.
Okay. I realize we haven't talked about funding.
Yeah, sure.
Your membership price on your website says it's $5 for a membership.
Yeah, it is $5 for a membership. What we want to do with members is to encourage them to become members. If for some reason $5 is too much, we can even talk about a payment plan for that, and it's not a big deal for us. What we want to do is we have this vision of a medical service that provides things that is also affordable. So we're trying to figure how that works. And we're independent. We are not funded by the province. But having said that, some of our services are medically billable by the province. Right now, we're starting to move towards that, with the acknowledgement for ourselves that we won't make the amount of money that a regular clinic makes, because those clinics could be, for example, owned by a doctor. And so the model is more an economically guided model, whereas for us, it's more a service model. We just want to provide services.
And so are you able to be self-sufficient with providing a few medically billable services? And I mean, obviously your membership shares are like, with 80 members, it's like $400 bucks, right? Like,
yeah.
So,
they're huge. We're making so much money.
So how do you keep the lights on?
We keep the lights on, with, as you can guess, fundraising and donations and grants. Our grants work for, a few projects. The mobile clinic in particular, we can build some of those services, but we also need money for the serious cases when we really need to put attention to somebody. Then that's always a little bit of our struggle for the mobile clinic. For the other clinics, it's a work in progress. We're working a system that incorporates the health broker and the doctor time, and we actually make money from that. We believe it's pretty close.
And the health brokers are mostly volunteers, right? Like,
no,
or all?
No. So we work with volunteers all the time, but the health brokers are our staff, basically.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we do pay our health brokers, because we do believe that they have very valuable skills that they're providing.
So looking back at your Facebook feed and the pictures that have gone all the way back, it really seems like this was a labor of love as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw some of the early pictures of the mobile clinics, and it's a budget truck with a banner on the side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a truck that just we had to rent, and we just created a banner and let's go. And it was really who would come to that clinic, right? But it was created by the goodwill of the partners that we've been working with, and the people that know the membership and the community that we work with. So it's really, they're the ones that are creating this. We just bring a truck. And so also our volunteers are amazing, and they put so much time in this, our doctors and everybody, our health brokers as well.
And the pictures also tell the story of the space that you now have. Mm-hmm. How did you come to get a space? Was this also from grants and stuff?
The space, we've been lucky. It was through donations that we've been able to afford a space. Every year we kind of think, okay, maybe this year we cannot afford a space. So that's there for us for sure. We operate just like any other not-for-profit organization. Without being non-profit, we're a co-op. We could be making money as a medical organization, but our role is a service model. So we try for that. We go towards that.
I noticed again, like, it looks like people are there putting in their own sweat and blood and tears to build this office.
Yeah, definitely. And it's what I like about the co-op model is that we do sit down together, figure out what's going on and how to solve it, and it's very powerful. Our director is also very strong guiding light, Haya Ranzen. She's amazing. She provides a lot of insight and a lot of support to us in that sense. Yeah.
And so, I mean, we've talked a lot about the funding challenges and and stuff like that. I mean, it sounds like, I was going to ask, you know, what have been the challenges in running the co-op, but it sounds like it's all been a bit of a challenge.
It's always a challenge, yeah, all the time, yeah. It's, but I mean, if you work in small organizations that work with the community, it's always like that. I don't think that's ever been different for nonprofits, so.
Can you share with us some of your success stories that you look back on or like, you know, this is why we do it?
Yeah, I think, well, I can tell you mobile clinic things because I've worked as a clinic coordinator. I can tell you that since we started, we saw 50 patients 1 year, and today we're seeing 200, 250 every year. And that's if you consider a very, very short amount of time every clinic that we create. And we don't have clinics like Monday to Friday from 9 to 5. We have them for like 4 hours, 5 hour periods once a week. So that's a very short amount of time. With a health broker, which automatically doubles our medical time. So, yeah, it's, I mean, to me, the amount of people that we're able to see and a couple of people that I know personally that we've actually helped them and made their lives a lot better, those are very powerful moments.
So for others who are out there, you know, looking for other healthcare co-op solutions, what would you tell them? What would be your sort of pearl of wisdom to share about how to get started on a project like this?
To get started in a project, to be patient, to definitely start getting together with people, getting in touch with co-ops and talking to them because they all want to share the information because they all want to see you do well. At the same time, once you find some of the ideas that you want, talk to a co-op developer, see how that can be done, and if there's grants out there for you to get a startup or a business plan, and yeah, go for it and try it because we didn't know we could do this and it's been going on for a while. So.
And so what are the future goals for the Umbrella Multicultural Health Co-op?
For Umbrella, well, we want to definitely stabilize ourselves. We've been like in expansion mode lately, so I know that we have to figure out how to be more stable in our service while continuing to provide good service. And I am hoping on a personal basis as a volunteer that we figure out if we can provide some kind of circle of conversation or kind of, I don't know what else to call it, but for men that just arrive to the country and face a lot of gender role issues or they don't really understand how things work here in their families or in their usual roles that they're used to having in their home country. And then they come here and they're so confused from this. And I've seen it in my family, in many other families that are not only from Colombia, because I'm from Colombia, or Latinas, but a lot of different communities I see face this. And that's a personal interest of mine as well, to figure out how we can create that. Because a lot of the time, we have lots of programs for women, and that is great. But I would also like to have a lot of programs for men.
That's interesting. I took a cross-cultural communication course at one time. We learned about the W model. Did you ever learn about that?
No.
So it's supposed to be your sort of your happiness index when arriving in a new culture. Mm-hmm. And you start at, you know, you just arrived and you're super happy and you're elated at the top of the W. And then you've been there a while and you realize how much you don't know and you kind of get depressed. And as you start to, so you're down at the bottom of the first part of the W, and then you start to realize how things work on a day-to-day basis, and you're able to, like, you know, get your groceries and figure out everything, and you're back up to being happy. Then you realize you're really not quite getting everything, and the context is a lot deeper than you thought before as you're down to the bottom. Yeah. And then slowly you climb back up as you acclimatize to the culture. And it sounds like you're trying to address some of these challenges that people face when coming to a new culture.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. I think so. Yeah, it was actually very familiar when you were describing that. I was like, yes, totally.
You specifically talking about this role for men, and I guess it's just a quite different culture for men, and like maybe you could just sort of explain what that difference is, mm-hmm. if you're able to.
Well, I think Canada in general, since I've been here, is very accepting of people that are different and diverse and have different beliefs. And what I've seen is that even if you're very young or very old as a man, you're kind of given all this information that you're expected, some norms that you have to follow. And when you come here, those norms are changed. And you don't know what's changed and what's not changed, and what should I believe, what should I not believe. And I've seen it I've lived it as my family came here, but I've also seen it in all the youth that I've worked with, in all the families that I've helped in throughout time, that's a struggle, that they don't know where to go, how to deal with that, because they're men. And that's something you don't talk about. And that's what I think is necessary to start changing that idea.
So how would you propose a program like this might look? I mean, you're talking about addressing something that's kind of, it's cultural, so obviously mm-hmm. it's a hard thing to break out of that cycle, but it's been like generations of seeing your parents and grandparents being people who don't talk about stuff.
Yeah.
How do you break into that shell?
I think you go very slowly at it. I think learning from other people that have done similar things, because I know that there's a couple of projects similar to this right now in Vancouver. So going through that and then very slowly establishing trust. And it could take months, it could take years before somebody decides to open. I think there's a lot of work to be done in that area for a lot of men. And not that we're going to reach everybody, but yeah.
Yeah, interesting. And so I just wanted to kind of ask a little bit about yourself. You mentioned before we started the show that you're interested in physiotherapy.
Correct, yes.
And do you see yourself becoming somebody who might participate in the health co-op in the future in that role?
Yeah, totally. I would love to do that. Part of the things we do with the co-op, at least with the mobile clinic, is we've tried to diversify the services we provide for our patients. And so we've been able to provide dentists and physiotherapists. And so I've learned a little bit about that, and I'm pretty excited that as to how that could look in the future. Yeah.
And you also mentioned that you believe in the power and flexibility of small local groups.
Yeah.
To achieve things that aren't achievable by larger organizations. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that? What does that look like to you?
It looks like the co-op that we're working in right now. Yeah. It looks like being able to create many projects, even if they're small. And then from there, you just see them multiplying because more people want to come, more people want to participate. And then it doesn't become so much about the money, but then it becomes a lot more about the community. And then the people that are actually interested that couldn't come before because they were afraid it was too big, now it's smaller, they can show up and just be themselves. And I think that's very powerful.
So did you have experience with co-ops in Colombia?
No experience with co-ops in Colombia. It was my experience, I was very young, maybe emotionally, mentally, when I came here. So I didn't know as much about that. But I've been very lucky that I got to learn about co-ops. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's inspiring that you've come here, you've become a Canadian, and it seems you've felt that you have this ability to help start these community organizations and find some real impact. And I'm wondering where did this all catalyze for you?
I don't know. Colombia is a very troubled place historically, and at least the generation that I was raised in, and from the 80s, a lot of us, we were tired about that. And we've always talked about the issues and tried to figure out ways to solve them. And that's, I think, a characteristic of the people in my generation, that that's very big there. And when I got here, it took a while, but then I figured out ways to do it that that could work for me.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming in this evening and sharing with us the story of the Umbrella Multicultural Health Co-op and also your own story.
Yeah, no problem. And I hope that you guys can come to the Salsa Night.
Yeah. We've been speaking with Camilo Cortez, and he is one of the founding members of the Umbrella Multicultural Health Co-op. If you want to check them out online, they're at www.umbrellacoop.ca. And they also have a Facebook group, which is facebook.com/umbrellahealthcoop. Again, co-op without the dash. That's it for us here on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. If you have any questions, emails, you can always tweet them at us at Each for All, or you can email at ideas@eachforall.coop. Our website is continuing to evolve, so check it out. It's eachforall.coop. And if you have any ideas for shows, do send us a line, and we'd love to have you on the show. Thanks for listening. This is Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. And you can always listen live online at coopradio.org. Have a cooperative evening.